Hi, this is Sherlanya Turner, and in this episode, AADL talks to Bill Minutaglio. In Dallas 1963, Bill Minutaglio paints a picture of the environment in Dallas in the early 60s and how a vivid cast of personalities fit together leading up to the tragic event.
I just finished reading your book, Dallas 1963, and the book was very interesting in that it took on this cast of over-the-top characters that made up Dallas in 1963. The questions I immediately have in mind for you is, what made you write this book, and what made you know that this was the way that you wanted to tell the story?
I used to live in Dallas for a number of years and work there. I was at the Dallas Morning News, which is the big newspaper in the city, and from my window I could see the Kennedy assassination site. It just almost seemed like I shouldn't, like it should be encased in a bubble. It was so accessible. I could walk over there in my lunch hour. In fact, when I first moved to the city, I lived probably about two blocks away from the site. So I would walk by it. And then later on, I worked right nearby it. For such a place that had really profound history. And again, it almost seemed like the entire area should have been turned into a museum, like something should have been airlifted from the clouds and encased the place. You know, the Kennedy assassination, even as the years went by, was always in the marrow, always in the DNA. It was just there, almost hiding in plain sight in a way. So one of my motivations was just spurred by the fact that I was thinking a lot about it. I could never avoid it. It was just there. On my way home, I would go by where President Kennedy had been assassinated, and it never went away. And I also worked at a place where periodically we would commemorate the event by doing anniversary stories, the 30th anniversary and so forth. And obviously, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary. So I was attuned personally to the clock. And noticed, not the only one, by the way, that the 50th anniversary was coming up. And just on a personal level, I felt I wanted to take a look and address some things that maybe I had been feeling and wondering about, things that I thought were in the shadows of the city, not to get all Halloween on you since it's that time
also
of year.
Also appropriate.
Yeah, not exactly. It's just I always felt that there was something more. And yes, the anniversary date was coming up. I knew a couple of years ago that we were approaching the 50th anniversary, which is obviously a watershed moment. With a colleague of mine, I've co-written this book with a really brilliant guy who happened to grow up in Dallas. I didn't grow up there. I grew up in New York and kind of wound my way to Dallas in 1983. My writing partner had grown up there. And as we got to know each other as friends on other projects, he was saying the same things. Said, yeah, there's something else there. Part of it was practical. We wanted to add something to the JFK canon, you know, the long list of books. But we wanted to do something original, just to be frank. But then also to address the sense of things that we thought were in the shadows, kind of hidden, neglected, ignored. One thing that I knew for certain as a reporter was that the city, even as late as 1983, when I had gotten there, was still suffering great unease and ambivalence. And I think shame, ultimately, about the Kennedy assassination. By that, I mean the folks in the city, the folks who could sculpt the city, had enough money and power and civic authority to do so, were at complete odds about how to address it. You know, should we commemorate it? Should there be a museum? Should there be any attention? And I think that was part of my befuddlement when I moved there, because there wasn't. You could just walk by these iconic places. I think they're iconic for people of a certain generation. The Texas School Book Depository, where Lee Harvey Oswald perched in a window and fired at the president. Dealey Plaza, where the president drove by. The Triple Underpass, the grassy knoll. These are words and terms that I think still resonate in history classes. It was just all there. It was oddly hiding in plain sight. And what we wanted to do was go a little bit deeper. And then the true motivation to finally answer your question was that we decided that the city of Dallas was the forgotten protagonist, that there were these acute protagonists, Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, and others, but that the city itself, it required a biography and one that was bounded by time and a true sense of place. So we decided to write a book about the 3 years really prior to the Kennedy assassination. And I'm afraid to say this, I got scared writing my book or researching it.
Tell me more about that.
Okay, well, thanks for asking. And I don't put on tinfoil hats at night and see black helicopters coming outside my window or think that people are following me. All of that might be happening, by the way, but I don't really ascribe to it. I'm not that important to warrant all that. But, you know, we began almost innocently saying, you know, it might be kind of an interesting book to take a look at what was going on in the city. But as we dug deeper, we began finding stuff that we think was both deliberately exiled to, you know, the corners of history, that it was intentionally marginalized and then just simply forgotten in a more benign way over time, that Dallas truly was the most singular, in my estimation. I'm heavily biased in this regard because I wrote a book called Dallas 1963. That Dallas was the most singular city in America in that time period from 1960 to the day President Kennedy died in November of 63. There was no city like it. Every city is distinct. But what I really mean is that Dallas was a really scary place. And it began to scare me as I sat alone in archives around the country reading firsthand accounts of what was going on there, the documents written by many of the protagonists in our book and then preserved by their families, many of which hadn't really been seen before. They just simply hadn't been examined. So what do I mean? There were a handful of folks in Dallas, 7, 8 to 10, who, as I say, lived above the cloud line. They were really, really powerful. They had command of the pulpits in town. In other words, they were the leading preachers in town. They had command of the upper echelons of business in town. The world's richest man lived in Dallas. He was an oil billionaire. The person that essentially controlled the public microphone, the most powerful media magnate, I maintain, in the south of the United States, would happen to be headquartered in Dallas. You had disenchanted military generals, very, very powerful former military figures coming to Dallas, and on and on and on. There was a handful of extremely powerful and very vocal and action-oriented figures, a distinct minority, by the way. I think most people in Dallas either liked Kennedy or, if they didn't, respected his office, and that there were a handful of other folks as we began doing our research. This is where it got scary. I just didn't know the depth of their virulent and vitriolic hatred of Kennedy and how they had been spending a lot of time and frankly, millions of dollars to get him out of office. And I'll use a provocative term, you know, by any means necessary. I don't abide by, you know, the conspiracy theory that some folks, you know, put Oswald up to it. And I might be wrong. I don't know. I that's just a different thing. Our book is not a conspiracy theory book. It's about these people, these very intense, almost cinematic, driven to action people in Dallas, a handful of them who had the means, the money, the muscled up will to attack Kennedy in almost any way short of outright violence. They brought it right up to the skittering edge of that, and it was something I didn't know. I think I was also scared, if I may say so, because I spent 18 years as a reporter at the Dallas Morning News. I wrote a column about the city, and all of my stories, the ones that I was proud of anyway, were about the history and context of the city, and this is stuff I didn't know. I was scared at what I didn't know and humbled by what I didn't know as a reporter. I think really good journalism is informed by history and context. But there were moments when I was alone looking at stuff that I had accumulated. And this is old history now. It's 50 years. It scared me. It scared me to think that a few people could kind of hijack the civic dialogue and then act in, frankly, an almost lunatic and hysterical way to objectify someone, not just even on a political level, but on a personal level. They hated Kennedy. They absolutely hated him.
Interesting. So what surprised you the most? I was certainly surprised when I read your book by the way that you painted these guys. When I started the book, I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting. Then I kept reading it because you never know.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah.
And kept reading it, and I thought if you were writing this as a novel, like if one were writing this as a novel and had these characters as over the top as they were,
sure.
your critique group would just look at you and they would write all over your manuscript and they would say, this is totally unbelievable. This billionaire would not do this. This former general would not do these things. How could he turn? Yeah. He was a man of great responsibility and now he's all way over here. How does that happen? Yeah. What surprised you the most?
Well, thank you for – I could tell you read my book, so that's it. That makes one so far. I'm happy, aside from a couple of my relatives maybe. But so thank you. I was thinking this morning on the way over to come talk to you, and I'm enjoying our conversation, that it's a cliche, you know, when people say, you know, you couldn't make this stuff up for writing-telling purposes, for storytelling purposes. If you look at our book, I think it's narrative or attempted at being very narrative. In other words, there's a plot to it and it's unfolding and we have these people appearing and it's written in the present tense, which I think for a lot of literary nonfiction, even journalism, is really like playing with fire. It's very difficult to do. I've tried to do it over the years on other projects. Even when I wrote a book many years ago about President George W. Bush, and I wrote a lot of it in present tense, and it's very difficult to do to have fidelity to the truth, but at the same time suggests that you were there, that it's really living history. I was thinking on the way over here, I had a very selfish motivation. I have two children, one of whom is 20 and another who's 15. The 15-year-old is kind of like going on 30. He's behaving. I really want them – of course I do. I want them to read my books. But I really wanted them to read this one because I think some of the lessons in it are really important. And they're of the here and now. What was happening in Dallas, I think, is happening today. We have a lot of people yelling at each other in Washington. It's very polarized, and I don't think that's any great revelation, but people seem to just scream at each other, and it seems to sometimes reach this almost hysterical, crazy level. And I'm thinking, you know, as a dad about the world my kids are going to go into and will participate in as citizens and hopefully caring about other people, their neighbors and maybe the communities they live in. So I'm thinking maybe there's a few lessons from what happened then, how people – some people stopped talking and it got really dangerous and maybe it even influenced the death of a president. So I decided to write the book or suggested to my colleague that we write the book in a very, very narrative way, in a very action-oriented way and frankly almost a cinematic way because I wanted my kids – I love them both. Sometimes they have short attention spans and I got to hook them. I got to hook them like fish. We wanted fidelity to the truth, of course, but I really wanted it readable. I didn't want them to view it as some ancient 50-year-old, you know, for my kid 50 years old, might as well be the Civil War. You know, it's just like, I don't care, Dad. So I think I was inspired. We were both. We want our children to read it because they're going to be inheriting the future and hopefully making the world a better place than it is today. And so that was an impulse. It literally was. It was actually a thought. Of course, I hope that anybody else would read it and maybe say, hey, this is – it's not dusty history. It's living history. You know, when you do any – I think any book, I would say for fiction or nonfiction, you create a plot map. You begin to say, well, you know, it's a longer work of writing. You know, where do I begin and can I ever get to the end and not veer off here and there, you know, like Alice in Wonderland, 20 different rabbit holes over here and am I opening the right doors? Is there a progression? And what we found that was almost perversely fortunate was that there were these people who were so, as you said, you know, outsized, over the top. They were a collection in some ways of what I call negative superlatives. You had the world's richest man living in Dallas who hated Kennedy and was spending millions of dollars to create, I believe, extremist radio for the first time in America. He created a radio broadcast that was heard by 10 million people and it was virulently, consistently anti-Kennedy, calling him a socialist, a communist, on bended knee to every other entity around the world that he was selling us out right there in Dallas and funding, you know, this very aggressive campaign. He was the money man. You had a preacher who was the most powerful Baptist preacher in America. He was the head of the largest Baptist congregation in America. One of the members of his congregation was a famous evangelist named Reverend Billy Graham. And this was First Baptist Church of Dallas, the largest Baptist congregation in America. And this man was extremely influential. His name was Reverend W.A. Criswell. Not a lot of people know this about him, but he had been a staunch anti-integrationist during the 1950s and had traveled throughout the South calling people who were interested in – well, you know, the Supreme Court in the 1950s ordered the desegregation of public schools in America in a watershed decision, Brown v. Board of Education. Criswell from Dallas hated it and traveled the country calling integrationist infidels and had great contempt for them. By extension, out of Dallas, Texas, he led this real interesting attack against Kennedy because he didn't know what Roman Catholicism was. And he thought it was some sort of a, quote, exotic religion. You know, we talk a little bit today about Islamophobia. And back then there was Roman Catholic phobia. And this guy in Dallas was spearheading it. He thought that Kennedy, as a Catholic president, would be on bended knee to the Pope, to this sort of dark arts Roman Catholicism. He really believed it, and he really traveled around the country, and he was followed by millions of people. So right there out of Dallas, the world's richest man, the most powerful Baptist preacher in America, you have the most strident media magnate opposed to Kennedy happened to be living in Dallas. So this amazing confederacy welling up. Fate and circumstance caused all these people to be there. That's why I say it was the singular city in America. The publisher of the Dallas Morning News loathed Kennedy. He made a point of going to the White House early in the Kennedy administration to scream at Kennedy, literally to get in his face at what was a kind of a social luncheon at the White House. He's wagging his finger. He accused Kennedy directly in Washington of being like a little child. His quote was, "You're just like Caroline, your daughter. You're riding a tricycle. You're not a man on horseback. You're afraid to annihilate the Soviet Union. You're afraid to drop a nuclear bomb in the Soviet Union, aren't you?" And took it to a whole other extreme level. It made some national headlines back then. And he was really reviled by a lot of American publishers. But by the most strident anti-Kennedy media figure in I think the country happened to be in, of all places, Dallas, Texas. Quietly, by the way, in terms of his personal animus, he was ordering his reporters at the paper where I used to work, by the way, to investigate some rather salacious rumors about Kennedy. Related to his upbringing. He wanted specifically to know whether Kennedy had been married before. It had a secret marriage prior to his one to Jacqueline Kennedy, and that somehow or other the Kennedy dynasty, because they're powerful and had a lot of money, made it all go away, just made it disappear. They did something with the paperwork. To me, and again, I'm not making any political observation here. I'm just making almost a repertorial observation that you could take a look at some of the suggestions or accusations or suspicions about President Obama as it relates to where he was born and even what his religion might really be, even though he's said it's one thing. Some other folks are lingering with other possibilities. So kind of interesting. And then you go on and on. The real out front, the kind of titular nominal head of the anti-Kennedy resistance in America, really the general was a general, Major General Edwin Walker. Had been booted out of the military. He was a World War II hero, a guy who ironically had helped to enforce federal orders integrating schools in the South right after the Brown v. Board of Education ruling by the Supreme Court. He led federal troops in the South that protected black students as they tried to attend formerly all-white segregated schools. In the later 50s and in the early 60s, he began having a lot of different feelings, and he felt that the upper administration of American government was riddled with communists, with socialists, that in fact integration was a socialist plot to weaken the Constitution, weaken the nation. That he went to another extreme. While he was a major general overseeing tens of thousands of troops in Europe, he began ordering his troops to read extremist literature. He began telling them how to vote for extremist politicians. He began saying that President Harry Truman was probably a socialist, that former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was probably a socialist, and that they all had communist tendencies. That really didn't work out well for him in the military, and he was basically expelled. A major general expelled for having extremist views, some said treasonous views. So he's expelled from the military by Kennedy, President Kennedy, and does what? He decides to move to Dallas, Texas, because it's a very comfortable and welcoming environment. And when he goes to Dallas, he's given the keys to the city by the mayor in a big public ceremony. He wound up on the cover of Newsweek magazine and national publications as sort of the nominal out front face of this anti-Kennedy movement. He loathed Kennedy, hated him, thought we were going to all die in the United States because Kennedy was going to roll over to the Soviet Union. An atomic bomb would kill us all. So what a convergence. You had generals, publishers, spiritual leaders, oil billionaires who had so much money that they could afford fund these efforts. And they wound up in Dallas. It wasn't by design. They weren't all calling each other and saying, hey, let's all get together. It just so happened. It became this place. And I've really wrestled with that a lot. You know, why Dallas? Why not some other city? There's something else in Dallas that's part of being in Texas. It's a city that's predicated on self-invention. Dallas, in a lot of ways, has no reason to be there. There's no port. There's not a waterfront. And no snow-capped mountains. There's no real natural resources right in the city. So it's a place that's very entrepreneurial and was built by people who claim that it's kind of a manifest destiny way. You know, we built something out of nothing. We're out on the frontier with our muscled up will created this place. And we did it in spite of government. We did it all on our own. You know, Texas used to be its own country. still might be. I don't know, some people say. I think that's part of what happened in Dallas. People felt we were born this way. We built this damn city on our own without government help. In fact, in spite of government oversight and regulation and the big hand of Washington and what we might consider socialism. And then, in fact, we're just more patriotic. And not only that, we're entitled because we are Americans. We're super patriots to play at a national and even international level. So not beyond our reach. We can affect change nationally and even internationally. Why shouldn't we? Just because we happen to be in the middle of the country as opposed to in Washington or in New York. It was part of the thinking there. The crazy thing to me was – and by the way, people were beginning to write this – that there was a lunatic fringe developing in Dallas that was really skittering. It was like drops of water on a hot plate. It was starting to skitter and get overheated. It was a hothouse. There was something wrong. People were beginning to write about it and notice it all happening in Dallas. Very, very quietly because these folks had kind of hijacked the microphone and the pulpits. They had the means and the money to do so. That forgotten were the fact that there were tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people in the city who either loved Kennedy or at least respected the office. And they were a little more centrist, to use a modern word, or a word that we use a lot more often now, who didn't feel that virulent, almost personal hatred toward him.
Sure. One of the things that stood out to me a little bit when I was reading your book had to do with that mink coat mob with the ladies who got really – and maybe this is just a gendered reading of things. But when I read about these women who were really violently angry and had banded together pushing Lyndon Johnson and his wife around, that stood out. And then to read later about the lady who hit Adlai Stevenson with the picket sign. Like you don't normally think about women wielding a picket sign to whap someone on top.
Yeah, contextually, sure. You're a good student of history. And again, thank you for reading the book because the Adlai Stevenson incident comes much later in the book. So I know you didn't fall asleep. I worry that people fall asleep. So I thank you for that. You must have had some strong coffee to keep slogging through it. I appreciate that. And you know, you're right. This is really more your ability and understanding of history than it is mine, especially as it relates to gender in history. But yeah, we're talking 50 years ago in a deep southern place. Dallas was very southern.
Well, that's the other thing that stood out about that, right? Because like when you think about the mores of the South and how a lady is to comport herself.
Yeah, there was this sort of sense of decorum that emanates in certain maybe southern social circles. I don't want to objectify entirely. But yeah, what you're referring to was really the first manifestation of this civic hysteria. This thing. Something was going really crazy down there. 1960, it was the closest presidential race at that time in American history. Bobby Kennedy, President Kennedy's brother, was managing his political campaign and he just couldn't believe that the race was so tight in Texas of all places. He was actually livid. I don't know if I'm allowed to use slightly blue language, but I'll throw it out there. He said to his brother, he said, there's a reason we have that son of a bitch, Lyndon Johnson, on our ticket. It's to win Texas. He's from Texas. And yet it's close in Texas, and this race is the tightest one in presidential history. I want him to get down to Texas right now, just a few days before the 1960 election, to shore up Texas. If we lose Texas, then why did we have him on the ticket? And we might not win the election. So LBJ went down there with Lady Bird Johnson, who's a very elegant or had been a very elegant and very demure person, very dignified, often wore white gloves, maybe a stereotype in a sense of a southern – an affluent southern person. They showed up for a speech 4 days before the election. It was in Dallas and they were attacked by a mob. And the mob has been called, as you said, a mink coat mob. These were folks who were the finest citizens in town. They were wealthy. They all shopped in the finest store in the southern portion of the United States called Neiman Marcus, very famous for its lavish offerings. And these were folks, by and large women, about 300 or so, who were married to really prominent businessmen, elected officials. And yet they had gotten advance word that LBJ was coming to town to give a speech. Last-minute speech, let's win some votes. And they attacked him and they attacked Lady Bird Johnson right in the lobby of the nicest hotel maybe in the state of Texas in downtown Dallas. And it was extremely, unpleasant is hardly the word. It was frightening. They began spitting at Lady Bird Johnson. They tried to hit her with signs. People were pulling hat pins out of their hats and trying to stab them. There were several injuries. People had to be taken to the hospital with broken bones. The police had to come in. What also happened, by the way, was the cameras were rolling. This is one of the early indicators of how powerful the media, you know, really can be, especially broadcast media. Cameras were rolling, and later that evening, images of these folks in Dallas, the staid, powerful, and usually contained and civic-minded folks of Dallas, going berserk. I mean, when you look at the footage, you see their faces twisted in rage. It's positively scary and seemingly so unlikely, you know, given the pedigree. These were thoroughbred people. They attacked then-Senator Johnson and his wife. They were staggered because it was home turf in a way. It was back in Texas. But those images were broadcast nationally, and some historians say, in a fit of irony, that the images helped to sway the election, that some people around the nation saw this scary moment and responded in sympathy to LBJ and maybe especially to Lady Bird Johnson. She was horrified. She was terrified that they voted in sympathy for the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. It was a really ugly episode. Richard Nixon, some years later, in the White House, told someone, you know, we lost that election, and forgive me, I'm going to use another blue word. We lost that election because of the asshole who had led that riot, again called the mink coat mob riot against Kennedy and Johnson. He was referring to the local congressional leader who had kind of organized the efforts. And he said, we lost the election because of that blankety blank congressman from Dallas. So it was a pivotal moment. You couldn't script it. And then in a negatively redundant way, that was in November of 1960, in the years, then months building up to Kennedy's fateful arrival in November of 63, there were other episodes, including some that were exactly like it. I mean, it was just replicated. It was a real black eye for the city. And Dr. Martin Luther King came to Dallas in early 1963 to give a speech. It was a halcyon moment. It was victory for folks in Dallas who had been wanting him to come there for years. And I don't know this, but I think he might have been warned, don't come to Dallas. It's just – it's too extreme. Dallas had once been the national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. And a lot of things I think were still in the marrow again. But he finally came in January of 63, again, you know, several months before Kennedy was going to come. It was just meant to be a great, joyous moment. He was going to talk about healing and – people just talking to each other, fine, let's stop this polarization. And yet there was a bomb threat lodged against him. You know, fortunately, nothing happened. In the rest of the year, there were other unbelievable incidents. Swastikas were found plastered all over the finest stores downtown that happened to be owned by Jewish merchants, including Neiman Marcus, where the mink coat mob and all the affluent people in town. At night, somebody ran around town putting swastikas. A cross was burned on the lawn of a Holocaust survivor in Dallas, probably in reaction to the fact that he had been out giving talks that were really about healing and how he had endured something so horrible, but the city needed to try to not be so polarized. And he came home one night and there was a cross burning. Little children, there were a couple of kids who were picked up by the cops for wearing Nazi armbands and carrying swastika emblems, and they had a whole bunch of gunpowder. These were children, teenagers, and I think one was only 12 years old, who were picked up outside of a temple, a Jewish temple, and they were planning to try to blow it up, and on and on and on. And it culminated in Adlai Stevenson, the United Nations ambassador, coming to Dallas to give a speech to talk about the U.S. not being xenophobic. You know, we need to just talk to more nations, and maybe that might be the key to turning off this nuclear countdown clock. You know, there was an age in contextually where people were really worried. We were just going to blow each other to kingdom come. I mean, it was a scary. I grew up a little bit then, and I was in third grade, so I wasn't very self-aware, but I knew enough to probably be scared. You know, I lived in a time period where we would go in the hallway and practice hiding in case there was an atomic attack. So it really was in the air. And Adlai Stevenson, who was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was out suggesting we needed to talk. Let's not annihilate. Let's not do what some of these guys in Dallas say. Let's not blow them up first before they blow us up. He came to Dallas to give a speech toward that end, and the same thing happened as with the mink coat mob. He was attacked. In fact, he was afraid for his life. He gave a speech, and as he walked out, several hundred people were waiting for him outside an auditorium in Dallas, hit him with signs, spit at him, and tried to get him. And he really did escape with his life. Stanley Marcus, who ran the famous again Neiman Marcus, saved his life. He grabbed him by the collar, pulled him in a car. They drove away. This is 1 month before Kennedy came to Dallas in November of 63. And and Adlai Stevenson, who's a very erudite, very elegant, and usually unflappable man. He had run for the presidency himself, turned to Marcus. He was just in a complete panic, and he said, are these in Dallas, are these humans or are they animals? That image, again, same thing happened. It was broadcast nationally, and people began developing this sense of what the hell, you know, this is a city of hate. And very regrettably, and I think now this is probably mildly political, so forgive me. I think we've seen that before where a handful of folks on both extreme left and right kind of hijack the dialogue and create this hysteria and then this lack of discourse. In October of 63, Stevenson, you know, basically relayed messages to Kennedy, don't go there. It's just unhinged. It's a really dangerous place. And other people were telling Kennedy that in Dallas, people were phoning and trying to get messages to them, don't come here, don't come here. We, you know, we love you. Most of us, again, either love you or at the minimum respect the office. But there are this handful, these people who have moved to this unhinged state that will pose a danger to you. And, you know, I'm not trying to be overly dramatic, but by that point it was too late.
To learn more about Bill Minutaglio, visit www.billminutaglio.com. Music for this episode was Colors by Manuel Ochoa, which you can find in the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnitude. AADL Talks to Bill Minutaglio is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.